listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. A quick shout out to our new affiliates. Three of them just started with us this week. A couple others have been with us for a little while, but I haven't specifically shouted out to them. So just very quickly, KPFK FM 90.7 in Los Angeles, KNSJ FM 89.1 in San Diego, KBBF FM 89.1 in San Francisco, KBCS FM 91.3 in Seattle, and starting, I believe, next week in Portland, KXRY FM 91.1. All Pacifica affiliates. We're really pleased to join to welcome all of these stations to the to our program, or vice versa. It is Thursday, but Senator Bernie Sanders is with us today. He's not going to be available tomorrow, so we're doing a special Thursday Brunch with Bernie edition. And Bernie will be taking your calls right after the first break. So if you have a question for Bernie in our National Town Hall meeting, even though today is Thursday, it's Brunch with Bernie a day early. Senator Sanders, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
There's a lot going on in the world, a lot going on in Congress, and I'm sure a lot on your mind. You want to share with us what's...
Yeah, I do. The reason I'm not going to be on the show tomorrow is we're heading to Madison, Wisconsin in the morning to be part of that Fighting Bob Fest. The folks in Wisconsin do a great job on that, and I'll be there at an event tomorrow night and one on Saturday morning. So I want to just say thank you and to all of our friends in Wisconsin.
And please be sure to tell them hi for me. I've spoken at the last two of those.
I truly will. Well, obviously, I think the issue on everybody's minds is the president's proposal to develop a military strike against Syria and get us involved in a horrendously bloody and complicated civil war there. And I can tell you, Tom, that in my office now, we have received, I imagine, hundreds of phone calls and many, many more emails. And the sentiment here in Vermont, at least, is overwhelming. I mean, overwhelming. Overwhelmingly against the United States getting involved. And I think, you know, people are raising a wide range of issues. But here is where I'm coming from. And I have to keep an open mind because there is no resolution out there. The resolution may, in fact, be changed. And I want to hear what the administration has to say. But here are my concerns, and they're a little bit different than many of my other colleagues. I don't have to tell any of the listeners to this show that this country, the United States, faces enormous problems. The middle class is disappearing. Real wages have gone down. Many of the new jobs that are being created are part-time jobs without benefits. Real unemployment is 14% for young people. It's higher than that for black kids. We're talking about 40% unemployment. We have the planetary crisis of global warming dealing with us. We have an infrastructure which is crumbling. We have, you know, millions of families no longer can be able to afford to send their kids to college. I mean, we got problem after problem after problem. And as dysfunctional as the United States Congress is today, as much as many of my Republican colleagues really want simply to cut back on Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, education, it seems to me that if we get involved in another war, and we've been in war now for something like 12 years, get involved in another war, the ability of Congress or the willingness of Congress, as bad as it is now, to pay attention to the enormous needs of the American middle class will become significantly less. So you're not going to hear much discussion about the need to create jobs or raise wages or rebuild our infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. Because you got a whole lot of folks in the Congress who really believe that the United States government should not be involved in protecting the middle class, that one of the chief functions of government, maybe the only function, is the military. And what I really worry about very much in my heart is after 12 years of war, after two separate wars, after you know, some 6,000 very brave men and women have been killed. Tens and tens of thousands came back with traumatic brain injury or PTSD. $3 trillion having been spent by the time we take care of our last wounded veteran. I don't sense that the American people have much appetite to get involved in what could be a real quagmire. I think in Syria right now, It is Assad, clearly, is a horrendous dictator, very brutal guy, using poison gas, chemical weapons against his own people. And we've got to do everything that we can to try to bring democracy to Syria. But I just have very grave doubts that getting involved in another war there will achieve that goal. And I worry very much about the unintended consequences of a war. What does Iran do? To what degree is Iran part of this whole picture in some people's minds? Is this a prelude to another war with Iran? And the other issue that concerns me, frankly, is the United States is acting, would act, without the support of the United Nations, without the support of NATO. And I think it is a very dangerous precedent for a superpower to act unilaterally, because then we lose any credibility we might have in telling Russia 2 years from now or China 3 years from now, you know, you really shouldn't go to war against other countries. You should take that issue to the United Nations. It should be worked out diplomatically. And they will say, hey, who are you to be talking? You went to war unilaterally in Syria. So I think there are a lot of grave concerns that the American people have. I think the bottom line is that everybody is appalled at the use of chemical weapons. Everybody understands that Assad is a murderous thug. But I think that there is a sentiment in this country that the time is long overdue for the United States Congress to start paying attention to the very, very serious problems facing the middle class and working families of this country.
Other issues that you think are going to be dealt with in Congress coming up, or is this is just going to push everything out of the way?
I mean, you know, in Congress, it is very hard for many people to walk and chew gum at the same time. And to the degree that we become focused on this war, and here's another thing that happened just the other day, the Foreign Relations Committee, by a 10-7 vote, voted out a resolution. And I don't know, a lot of people looked at it, but included in that was an amendment offered by Senator McCain, which really calls not for what Obama was talking about, which was targeted strikes, very limited engagement. What McCain is really talking about is regime change. And that is strong support for the opposition. And by the way, when you talk about the opposition, what people have got to understand that a significant part, no one knows exactly how many, but a significant part of that opposition are Al-Qaeda affiliates, not nice guys, people who are not just interested in overthrowing Assad, but are interested in establishing an extreme Islamic republic there, where women's rights would be virtually non-existent and all the other elements that we see where these guys have power. So it is, to say the least, a very complicated issue. And I think what the sentiment that I'm perceiving, certainly here in Vermont, and I think around the country, is that people would like the Congress to start paying attention to issues that we really can have an impact, and we know what we're doing about, rather than getting involved again in a third war in 12 years, which would preoccupy our energy and our resources and prevent us from addressing many other important needs.
Yeah. I've been saying, while I oppose the idea of bombing these folks, I applaud the president for tossing this to Congress. Your thoughts on that? We have about 20 seconds.
I mean, you know, that's kind of what the Constitution of the United States is about. And the truth is, there have been presidents in recent years that have ignored that. But the president is absolutely right. This is a decision. Yeah, you can call it what you want, but when you start bombing people, it's called a war in my book. And the Constitution mandates that Congress makes that decision.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us a day early, our Brunch with Bernie hour right now. Your opportunity to talk with Senator Sanders in our national town hall meeting. Check out his website at sanders.senate.gov, by the way.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
That's sanders.senate.gov. Back with your calls for Bernie right after this short break. Welcome back. Occupying the Media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here on the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour, a day early. Senator Bernie Sanders with us right now. And Bernie, Craig had just called and said,
Craig, I think, expresses a sentiment that a lot of people feel. when we see photographs of children and other people killed as a result of chemical weapons by Assad, everybody's heart is turned, and we're disgusted by what we see, and we want to respond. But I think, Craig, the answer is not the question of whether or not the president's feelings are right. We're all repelled and disgusted by what we see. The question is, we need a policy to make a bad situation better, not worse. And there are many very smart people who know something about this issue, who worry that getting involved in a long, that what the president is talking about may not happen. That once you step foot into that quagmire, you may get sucked into it in a deeper and deeper way, and the end result may not necessarily be the kind of positive result that one had wanted in the beginning. So that's kind of the fear here. It's not that one doesn't want to do the right thing. It's that sometimes one's action results in ways that you really can't predict, and sometimes those results are pretty bad.
Mike in Chicago, you're on the air with Senator Sanders. Thanks for listening to WCPT.
Yeah, Senator Sanders, if you listen to John Kerry and the president over the weekend, my gut instinct tells me he's going to hit them. He's going to hit Syria regardless if the Senate votes for it. So my question to you is, what would your feelings of the presidency be, or Obama, if he goes against the representatives and the senators and goes ahead and hits them?
I think it would be a disaster for the president. I think people would say to him, Mr. President, first of all, you got a constitution. It's the Congress that makes war. And second of all, why did you go through the effort of involving Congress if you're going to ignore him? And I think he would look very, very foolish in doing that. So I hope very much that that course of events does not occur. I hope that the president listens to what Congress decides.
Jason in Dumont, New Jersey, listening to WWRL. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. I have a question. You know, when I see everything in Syria, my heart goes out to them. But I don't want another war. And I was thinking, couldn't we hit them in their wallet? Any aid that we happen to give Syria, we take away. Any country that we give aid to that helps Syria, we take away. Any country that helps those countries that we give aid to, we take away. I'd have to imagine that after just a few days, all countries would turn their back on Syria.
Well, Jason, you're suggesting a course of action that my wife feels very strongly about. It turns out that the Assad family, we don't know exactly what they are personally worth, but we think it's over $1 billion. This is a guy who has looted his own country and is extremely wealthy. Their family has endless amounts of money. And I think that doing everything that we can, look, it's not a question of doing a bombing or doing nothing. It's a question of how we can put significant amounts of pressure. And I think Jason is absolutely right. One of the ways you do it is to do very, very strong sanctions. Have we exhausted all of those capabilities? Have we made Assad an offer that he can't refuse financially by strangling him? I'm not sure that we have gone as far down that road as we should. And I think we have to explore those types of options before we start dropping bombs.
Frank in Cambridge, Mass. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking my call. The two things. One of the things that scares me about this is that I've listened to the Democrats' response and even local representatives in the wishy-washy response of the Senate, and I have a feeling that there's a chance that Obama, if he carries out with this, could destroy the Democratic Party in the sense that we want to vote for people who are going to vote for war mindlessly, and all the facts aren't in yet. The fact, one of the people who said this the other day was the timeline is all off. They say they knew about this before it happened. Well, why didn't they warn them then or attack then? The other thing is, do you see any possibility of the emergence of a Labor Party if this thing should come crashing down on their heads? Because I don't want to vote for wishy-washy people who just go do whatever the hell they want to do in Washington. I want to vote people who are going to represent us. And those are the things that you profess, the things that you talk about. That's us.
Well, thanks, Frank. And you know, thanks for your point. You make some important points. Frank is worried that if Democrats vote for this war and get dragged into it, a lot of people who supported Democrats are going to just turn away in disgust. And I think his point is a good point. I think no one, I think, would deny now that the enthusiasm that originally attached itself to Obama when he was first elected is largely gone. There is enormous concern about the NSA and the spying that we have seen. And every day there's another revelation about that. There's a strong concern that he has not been as tough as he should be in taking on right-wing Republicans and explaining to the American people what these guys stand for, and instead too often making bad compromises. And I think what Frank says, well, if Democrats go along with this war, there's going to be a whole lot of people out there who are saying, what is the difference between these parties? The concept of a party, a Labor Party, you know, I am an independent. When I was mayor of the city of Burlington, we formed the third party, which unions played a very active role. And it may, in fact, evolve to that. If they're right now, you know, Congress has about a 12% or 15% favorability rating. Democrats are bad. They're very low. And the Republicans are even worse. But I think the issue here that, how are we doing with time, Tom? Should we?
We need 15 seconds, sir.
I think the issue is that people, as Frank indicates, want Congress to be representing their needs, listening to them. And time after time, whether it's Social Security, whether it's jobs, whether it's Wall Street, Congress is busy.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
There you go, Bernie. Finish your sentence.
Okay. You know, the concern that, Frank has is shared by millions. Congress is not listening to the American people.
We'll be right back. Taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here on the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, Senator Bernie Sanders, a day early. Tomorrow he's going to be in Madison, Wisconsin. And to our Madison listeners out there, be sure and get out and check it out. He's going to be in Madison for the Fighting Bob Fest, which is a fine thing. So, Bernie, you're back with us?
I am right here.
Okay, well, let's pick up some phone calls here. Alex in Marblehead, Massachusetts. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you, Tom, and really appreciate what you stand for, Bernie. I was a lifetime-long Democrat until a couple years ago. Now I'm a proud independent. I have a couple questions for you. The assets that have been described off the coast of Syria are mostly ships carrying missiles, but they keep mentioning that there is one ship that's an amphibious ship, and I don't understand what the use of that would be for if we're not going to put any people on the ground, as they say, boots on the ground. That's my first question. And my next question, it seems like the Armed Services Committee, in all their amendments, has included some language that states the possibility of some non-combat personnel, which to me reeks of the advisors that went in Vietnam, and that just scares the hell out of me.
Okay, Alex, good questions. I think nobody anticipates that there would be any American troops in this initial attack on Syria. They would likely be cruise missile attacks in order to hit Assad's military infrastructure, his capability of delivering chemical weapons, whether that's his air force, his runways and the airports, or the actual mechanisms by which he develops these chemical weapons. I don't think anyone anticipates troops being involved in that. The second issue that you raised deals with not the Armed Forces Committee. It was the Foreign Relations Committee. And while you're right, there is some language maybe that in an emergency something might happen. I think the initial concern is not that American troops are going to be in Syria next week. That ain't going to happen. Here's what the concern I think should be. People like Senator McCain have been pretty clear and open about it. that they really do not want to do what Obama has been talking about. What Obama has been saying is he wants to punish Assad for using chemical weapons and prevent them from doing that again. It's a limited goal. What people like Senator McCain and others are talking about, really, and a McCain amendment to the Foreign Relations Bill included this language in so many words, really speaks to a regime change, really speaks to the overthrowing of Bashar Assad. Now, to do that, you're going to have to arm the opposition very significantly. At some point down the line, you may have to train them and organize them in a lot better way than they are now. Are you going to have to deal with the fact that a significant part of the opposition are Islamic fundamentalists, some of them affiliated with al-Qaeda, all very complicated stuff. And then you have to ask yourselves, well, what happens after all of that? The war doesn't go well. Does somebody then say, and this is where Alex's question is relevant, well, we need to bring some people in there to start training these combatants. And once you start training them and you have troops on the ground, what else follows from that? So Alex is, you know, is raising a legitimate concern. Can I tell you that that's going to happen? No, and I certainly hope it won't. But once you get involved in something as complicated, this is enormously complicated. I mean, you are now talking about standing on the side of an opposition of which maybe one quarter of them are affiliates of al-Qaeda or other fundamentalist groups. I mean, do we feel comfortable doing that? And many of these guys, the extremist groups, are very, very motivated. They are very strong fighters. They sacrifice. They die. So it just becomes a very complicated issue that should concern us all.
Charles in Opa-locka, California, or Florida, excuse me. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Opa-locka, Florida. How are you doing today, Senator Sanders?
Hey, Charles.
Hello.
Hi, how are you, Charles?
I'm great. I feel like I'm one of the constituents, although I live in Miami, Florida. to be honest with you, I have an open-ended question. And my question is really, what has George Bush and these conservatives done to America since he took over in 2002? First of all, we thought that he took the election instead of winning it. Mm-hmm. He brought us into a war that was unjustified. And I say that only because our strongest ally, the UK, does not want to get involved in this situation because they feel like they've been duped before. And also through his administration, because of that crash, they are also suffering. And you have to look at the fact that there are some type of, austerity.
Yep.
And, you know, those people, and that's one of the big reasons why a lot of people aren't getting into America, because we've lost our credibility. Mm-hmm. Second of all, Vladimir Putin seems like he's taken a page out of George Bush's pocket, because a lot of people have speculated on how he won in his election also. So there's a correlation there. And finally, where's Paul Ryan? All this time he's in the neocons have been saying that Iran is building a bomb, and, you know, he's not speaking out anymore, because it's like they're pushing an issue that's not really there. And last of all, it goes back to at the end of this month, when we're getting into that debt fight, the conservatives don't want to go into Syria, because that's going to detract from what they really want to attack Obama on, and that's this debt fight.
So let's let Bernie respond to that, Charles.
That's a lot of stuff out there, Charles, and thanks for your thoughts. Let me try to put your thoughts together and tell you what I think. What I worry about very much is that we went to war in 2002, went to war in 2003. We have been at war now, you know, for 11 years. And while we have been at war, what else has been going on in this country? Well, what's been going on in this country is the middle class has been collapsing. Poverty at 46 million is almost an all-time high. The people on top are doing phenomenally well, while most everybody else is financially in trouble. And then you got a Congress right now, a House of Representatives, who are saying that the only way they can deal with deficit reduction is by continuing to make massive cuts on programs that working families desperately need, especially in these difficult economic times. So my worry is that you get involved in this war and that maybe it drags on and on. Maybe we get more and more involved. Maybe, and I can't predict this will happen, but it's the fear, start spending billions of dollars. Maybe you get sucked into training troops, et cetera, et cetera. Meanwhile, back home, what's happening to ordinary people? The middle class will continue to decline. There'll be less money available to take care of our kids. We already have the highest rate of childhood poverty in the industrialized world. And not only is it a question of money, to me it's a question of focus. If Congress is once again going to be focused on another war, who is going to be standing up and saying we need to create millions of jobs for working people in this country and for our young people? We need to raise wages so that people are not living on starvation wages. We need to protect Medicare and Social Security and Medicaid. Who's going to be talking about that issue when the worry will be what's going on in Syria or maybe with Iran? So I get back to the point that I feel very strongly about. This country faces enormous problems. We were once the envy of the world. We led the world in terms of our infrastructure, in terms of our health care, in terms of our education, in terms of our standard of living. That is no longer the case. And if we continue to spend all of our energy and our time and our money on war, I fear very much about the future of the middle class in this country.
Carol in Minneapolis, Minnesota. We have just a minute to the break. Carol, a quick question for Bernie.
Yes, I believe that Fukushima is our number one concern, and I also believe that our economic model of living beyond our environmental means are the two most important issues facing us, and I'm really concerned that we're not focused on those issues, and the fracking and the polluting scarce water resources that we already have, and I'd like his comment on that.
Well, I share those concerns. I mean, Carol raises a very important point. And that is, and again, it gets back to the Syria issue. If you're busy worrying about the war in Syria, you're not going to be worrying about global warming and the rising of the sea levels, which can impact many coastal communities in the United States and around the world. You're not going to be worrying about the potential dangers of nuclear energy, such as we saw in Fukushima. You're not going to be worrying about those issues. So to my mind, frankly, I wish we'd have a president right now, we get up there and say, we really have a crisis. Let me tell you what the crisis is. If we don't transform our energy system in the very near future, this planet is in serious shape.
Absolutely. We'll be back with more of Senator Sanders right after this. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour on the Tom Hartman program. A day early. It's Thursday. Bernie's off to Madison tomorrow for the Fighting Bob Fest. So he's taking your calls and your questions right now. We'll be right back with more of Bernie Sanders.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And you can check out Bernie's website for everything from his petitions to his constitutional amendment suggestion to his news at Sanders.Senate.gov. 10 minutes before the hour, welcome back to Senator Sanders. Our Brunch with Bernie hour, answering your questions a day early here. Kathy in Etna, Wyoming, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, here's one of these questions that I really would love to understand a little bit better. Currently, or I should say when we went to war in Iraq, we used from an interview I saw from a doctor that there are horrific birth defects going on because of our use of depleted uranium. So if Americans use depleted uranium, which I would consider a chemical weapon, on the Iraqi people, and now it's showing up with the bursts that are going on. Who are we, and how do we condemn a man, maybe, that has used chemical weapons on his own people? I mean, who are we to point a finger at somebody else when we do the same thing?
Well, I think, Kathy, we don't do the same thing. You're right. I studied that issue, and depleted uranium may be, well be, a cause of health problems for both Americans, by the way, troops that were exposed to that, as well as Iraqis. That is a different thing, I think, morally, than somebody who quite intentionally fires chemical weapons at innocent people. So I would say that morally that is a different thing. War always has inadvertent consequences. You know, the United States, you're right in the sense that, you know, we did drop nuclear weapons. We have used napalm. We kind of turned our backs when Saddam Hussein was using chemical weapons against his own people and Iran. So our hands are not perfectly clean. But I would say that the use of depleted uranium in Iraq is very different than a guy who intentionally fires missiles with chemical weapons against his own people.
Larry in Sugar Grove, Illinois. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator. First of all, I think of you as my representative, but I also have another Senator Dick Durbin.
Yep.
And I listened to his weak rationale yesterday defending war on Syria. It was so out of character. I have supported him for years and years. What's the reason for that? Is it pure politics? And how are we loyal supporters supposed to react to that?
Well, Larry, thanks for the question. I've known Dick for many, many years. We were in the House together, and he is a good friend of mine. Dick is, as you know, the whip of the Democratic Party in the Senate, the person right under the majority leader, Harry Reid. And Dick Durbin is obviously, as Illinois senator, very close to President Obama. In fact, the president often thanks Durbin for the role that he played in getting him elected. So I think one would be naive not to think that there are other considerations other than pure objective analysis of the Syrian situation. There are politics. There is politics involved. If Mitt Romney were the president of the United States now and he proposed this, how would the Democrats respond? Would they respond differently? I suspect that they would. So I think there is an inherent tendency on the part of some of the Democrats to say we've got to protect the president. Maybe in our heart of hearts we don't necessarily agree with him, but we can't leave him out there, and we've got to protect him for the good of the Democratic Party. So, you know, I think there is some of that in that.
Taya in Blackfoot, Idaho. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. I gave money to your campaign, Clear from Idaho. I admire you so much.
Thank you very much. I didn't know we had
many
supporters in Idaho, but I appreciate it.
Yeah, I know. My question is, what, I guess, power play do the oil companies have in this decision whether or not to go into Syria? And what kind of situation is created in Syria that might affect their access to oil and this kind of thing? I wonder, because they've got lots of money and lots of Congress people.
Are gas prices going up in Idaho?
Huh?
Have gas prices gone up in Idaho?
Well, right now they're the cheapest between Seattle and where I live in southeastern Idaho, because I just drove that way.
Well, in Vermont, prices have gone up pretty significantly in the last month or so.
Yeah, they have about 20 cents a gallon, really. Mm-hmm.
All that I could tell you is this. You know, when we talk about the power structure of America, I would say at the top of the list, the top of the pyramid, you put Wall Street. These guys have more money than anybody can believe, enormous economic power. Probably at the second rung would be the oil companies. ExxonMobil has in the past earned more profits than any corporation in the history of the world. They have, you know, they determine the price of oil not based on supply or demand or any rational economic reason, basically as much as they can get in a given moment. And one of the, you know, we haven't discussed this, Tom, but it is very likely if there is a, you know, conflagration in the Middle East, that, you know, the oil companies will be saying we're worried about our sources of oil and we're going to have to raise prices substantially. That would not surprise me. But basically, I think, you know, some of us have tried in various ways to deal with the oil companies, we try to deal with Wall Street speculation on the oil futures market. It is tough stuff because these guys are very, very powerful.
Mm-hmm. Bernie, we have about a half a minute left here before the end of the show, the end of the hour. Final thoughts for the day?
Well, I think, you know, we are in very, very difficult times. My sense is that in my own state of Vermont, and I think all over the country, people are less than enthusiastic about getting involved in another war and in a very complicated and bloody civil war in Syria. And I think people are asking the president, they're asking the Congress to start focusing on the very, very serious problems facing our country, to do what we can with the rest of the world, with the United Nations, in dealing with atrocities in Syria and elsewhere. But I detect a lack of enthusiasm nationally for getting involved in another war.
Bernie, thanks so much for being with us again this week.
All right, my pleasure. Take care, Tom.
See you next week. Have a great time at Fighting Bob. Say hi to Ed Garvey for me. Thank you. We'll be back with more right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Mike Papantonio, turning host of Ring of Fire Radio, on the line with us. Hey, Pap, we just had Bernie on for an hour. Senator Sanders, you're the perfect segue. How are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you, Tom?
I am fine, thank you. What's on your mind today? I'm guessing Syria might have something to do with it.
It certainly is Syria. You know, if you're looking at the news today, if you're looking at corporate media news, of course, you're not getting this part of the story. But it seems like all the attention, Tom, is turning towards, well, what does this mean for Israel? What does it mean for, you know, a whole host of other countries, without any discussion of why are we so willing to go fight a war on behalf of Prince Bandar or King Abdul and the Arab League? Because that's who's really behind a lot of this. Today, I know you know the story. Where you had Prince Bandar meet with the Russians and saying, listen, we'll be glad to give you $15 billion worth of arms if you'll stand down on this. We'll be glad to give you a place in the oil sales set up to where we're not going to interfere with your sales of oil to Europe. Now, think about how insane that is. And you have Kerry, of course, coming and making the pronouncement that Saudi Arabia has agreed to pay for us to put our troops in the line of danger to go fight this war for them.
We heard this on the Iraq one, too, by the way.
We certainly did. And so we miss the fact that, first of all, we miss the fact, who are the players here? The misdirection of corporate media, I don't know that it's misdirection or just sheer ignorance, Tom. But this is not a simple civil war we're talking about. These aren't a few rebels versus Assad. Assad is being targeted by Turkey. He's being targeted by virtually most of the Arab League. He's being targeted by King Abdul. He's being targeted by Prince Bandar. We miss the fact that mixed up in there is the age-old fight between the Sunnis and the Shiites. You have, that conflict still is playing itself out in many ways here. But the thing that is most troublesome here is if you listen as hard as you possibly can to corporate media, there's no discussion that what Saudi Arabia is doing is turning the United States into mercenary soldiers. So we will go fight their war. We'll pay you to do that. We'll sell. We'll buy arms from you to do that. We'll give you money to do that. We'll give you gas. We'll give you fuel to do that. And what is the difference between that and simply calling ourselves mercenaries? And that's the ugly part of this story that certainly Kerry's not willing to talk about, and certainly Obama is not willing to talk about. But it's a major part of this story. The very same people who we gave a pass on for 9/11, where most of the terrorists involved in 9/11 were Saudis. And so we acted like there was no connection. We acted like there was no problem, like there was no doesn't affect our relationship with Saudi Arabia at all. This is another incident where corporate America is ignoring this whole thing as Prince Bandar travels around the world as if he somehow is a victim here.
Yeah, formerly known as Bandar Bush for his close relationship to the Bush family. I pointed out on this program on Tuesday when we came back doing live shows that if you look at the west coast of Iraq, the western border, the western frontier of Iraq, which is where the newly developed oil fields are, the ones
right.
that Dick Cheney was dividing up in March of 2001 in his energy task force. These new oil wells that, because they're virgin oil wells, the oil is actually, many of them, coming out under pressure, making it the most profitable oil in the world. You don't have to spend $15, $20 a barrel on energy to suck on the straw to pull this oil out of the ground. It's coming out on its own. It's costing 50 cents a barrel to pump this stuff. It's enormously profitable oil. That's on that western border of Iraq.
Yes.
The western border of Iraq is the same thing as the eastern border of Syria. And the western border of Syria is also known as the Mediterranean, which is the entryway to Europe.
Perfect pipeline, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's so many parts to this that it seems that if you listen to what our president is telling us, it's almost like we listen and we say, okay, well now let me get this right. Is this a humanitarian fight that we're involved with? If it is, then let's handle it like we would any humanitarian problem. Let's sit down with the Russians. Let's sit down with the Iranians. Let's sit down with the Turks. Let's sit down with everybody at a table, the Chinese, and let's deal with it as a humanitarian problem.
And let's also take some of those billions that we want to throw in the form of military hardware, take those billions and put them into the refugee camps. I mean, you've got 2 million people living in hell right now.
Right. Tom, you realize in just 3 years ago, the McDonnell Douglases, the Halliburtons, the Brown Roots, the Boeings, the Raytheons, they were making in excess of $70 to $80 billion a year just in war contracts, in military contracts. Now that number has dropped to about $26 billion a year. The only thing that this president can do that makes any sense is say, listen, if I really, really sincerely want to make a decision, that I don't have Wall Street pulling my string to make the decision. I don't have corporate media pulling my string to make the decision. I don't have the oil pimps pulling, making decisions. I don't have the arms industry, the war hawk arms industry making this decision. The only way he can do that is ask them to get the hell out of the room and then to be honest with himself with what he's about to do here in the United States. You can't miss something, Tom. He's made some great decisions. He's stepped into this. He talked too aggressively. He may put a line in the sand, and now he's trying to walk back in a way, at least appear that he's walking back. But he wants a war, Tom. He absolutely wants a war. The generals that look at this say it's impossible to accomplish anything without putting boots on the ground. What are a few missiles going to do? Also, all Assad does is says, so what? Okay, yeah, you shot a few missiles over here, but I was over here. My regime is over here. It doesn't make any difference. Where does this really go? And this president understands that. He's in the midst of giving us the appearance that maybe he wants to walk back from that ridiculous rage that he showed without ever showing any real diplomacy first by drawing a line in the sand about chemical weapons.
That was a big mistake. I also think that there is a very small club of people who are killers, people who have killed other people and have done it under the cover of law. And that virtually everybody in the room with the president, all these guys with all the hardware on their shoulders and whatnot, they are members of that club. And there's a certain kind of sociopathy that comes with it. Once you've killed somebody, you become a different person. And I think that the first time that one of these guys sat down with President Obama and said, we need you to authorize the killing of this guy with a drone strike or whatever it may be, and it happened probably fairly early in his administration, that he went through a psychological transformation that you and I can't understand. We've never done this. And killing gets easier and easier. And I don't know, maybe I'm psychoanalyzing.
Well, no, I've heard the argument before, and that is we become what we're surrounded by.
Yeah.
And that's the part of the problem. He's surrounded by horrible advisors. I mean, from just the very inner circle, he has terrible advisors. People advise him not to prosecute Wall Street. People advise him to attack Social Security. Horrible advisors time and time again. But worse than that is he is surrounded with the beltway mentality that is controlled by the arms industry, McDonnell Douglas, Boeing, Raytheon. It's controlled
people
by
make money off death.
Yeah, it's controlled by corporate media. Just look at the last war that corporate media, I mean, my God, I remember Wolf Blitzer in some ridiculous room with holograms and yeah. maps everywhere, moving maps of where
and that's another media that makes money off death.
Of course they do. Of course they do. Yeah.
There you go. Mike Papantonio, you can listen to his program Ring of Fire Radio on the weekends and ringoffireradio.com. Learn all about it. He's also, they've got a new TV show, Ring of Fire Radio, Ring of Fire TV over on Free Speech TV. You can check it all out at ringoffire.com, ringoffireradio.com, right?
That's right.
Okay. Pap, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
That is Ring of Fire Radio. .com. Hey, it's Thursday. Let's get geeky on generosity. This is my 3 minutes to talk about something other than politics. University of Pennsylvania scientist Joshua Plotkin said that ever since Darwin, biologists have been puzzled about why there's so much apparent cooperation and even flat-out generosity and altruism in nature. Plotkin is a member of a research team that believes it's found the reason why. Thanks to new insights on the game theory matchup known as the Prisoner's Dilemma, researchers have shown how traits like generosity and cooperation actually contribute to the evolution and perpetuation of a species. The Prisoner's Dilemma is a way of studying how people choose whether or not to cooperate with each other. In the game, if two players choose to cooperate with each other, they both receive some kind of a payoff. If only one player decides to cooperate and the other doesn't, the cooperating player receives only a small payoff, while the non-cooperating player gets the biggest payoff, makes off with most of the money. If both players decide not to cooperate, they both receive a payoff, but it's less than they would have gotten had they chosen to cooperate. So basically, the Prisoner's Dilemma shows how it pays to cooperate with others, but it also pays to be selfish. So why would somebody not be selfish? Well, the research shows that generous strategies, where players usually cooperate with their opponents, are actually the most successful in the evolutionary version of the Prisoner's Dilemma game and in nature. And over the long term, generous strategies are the only strategies that work, period. UPenn scientist Joshua Plotkin said, quote, "Our paper shows that no selfish strategies will succeed in evolution. The only strategies that are evolutionarily robust are generous ones." So what does all this mean? Generosity and cooperation are essential for the evolution and success of a species. So quick, somebody tell the conservatives in Washington that their selfish ways are going to lead to the end of the human race. And no, that's not a joke. Okay. So a lot going on. I want to share with you, and I will be picking up your phone. I see we got phone calls from all over the country here. We will get to you in just a moment. But C.J. Chivers wrote this piece for the New York Times, and I'm guessing probably by the end of the day today or tomorrow it'll be the number one most forwarded story in the New York Times. I want to share just a couple of sentences from it. He starts out talking about how there's a group of Syrian rebels, and they've got prisoners on the ground, shirtless, terrified, tied up. And the rebels are just kind of standing around with their guns, casually, is the word he uses. He says the prisoners, seven in all, were captured Syrian soldiers. Right? They worked for Assad. Five were trussed, their backs marked with red welts. In other words, they'd been tortured, whipped, beaten. They kept their faces pressed to the dirt as the rebels' commander recited a bitter revolutionary verse. So here's what the commander said, only he said it in Arabic, of course. He said, "For 50 years, they were compatriots to corruption. We swear to the Lord of the throne that this is our oath. We will take revenge." The next sentence in the article. The moment the poem ended, the commander, known as the uncle, fired a bullet into the back of the first prisoner's head. His gunmen followed suit, promptly killing all the men at their feet. This scene, writes C.J. Chivers in today's New York Times, this scene documented in a video smuggled out of Syria a few days ago by a former rebel who grew disgusted by the killings, offers a dark insight into how many rebels have adopted some of the same brutal and ruthless tactics as the regime they are trying to overthrow. And then he goes on to point out that these guys, these killers, are the ones that we're arming, and they're the ones who are going to benefit if we go in and bomb Assad's people, the ones that they just killed. Do we really want to be in the middle of this thing? This is a 2.5-year-long civil war. This is just not our war. There's no other way to say it than that. It is not our war. Rick in Coos Bay, Oregon, listening on KBVR. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Yeah, I just need to make a comment about, well, you commented yesterday about people calling in and expressing their disapproval, frustration, and anger towards President Obama as primarily being just a bunch of Republican hacks, paid.
No, I didn't say that in the contemporary context. I said that before every election, I start getting all these calls about people pretending that they're Democrats and expressing that. And I also said that there are a number of real Democrats who will call and say the same thing. So, and I'm sure that you hear the same thing on the right wing.
And you know, I just do not trust this man. I supported him in 2008. I really bought into the whole hope and change. And honestly, I know FDR was the one, you know, that said you have to push me to get these things done. It was a different time and era back then, and I don't think that a man with the moral conviction, true moral conviction, would need to be pushed the way that Obama needs to be pushed. I mean, he would just instinctively do that. I may be crazy, you know, I don't understand Washington politics, whatever the case may be, but I think basically what we got was a bait and switch. And I'm very, very disappointed. And I think the media needs to call him out, whether it's Rachel, whoever, you know, that gets on the air, MSNBC. Call him out by name whenever, you know. And
that's not going to happen on
well,
any corporate network.
Just refer to the White House or the administration in vague terms, but just say, President Obama, this is wrong. And I
think the American people are saying that right now, Rick. I really
do. The media is not, and especially MSNBC. And as far as him going before Congress for approval on Syria, I disagree with you that it was a noble act. Sure, it's constitutionally, you know, the right thing to do, but I just don't think it was an act of nobility.
Okay, I'll withdraw the word noble. I think it was a both a politically and a constitutionally correct act, however. Thank you, Rick.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I think that there is a certain amount of courage, though, that it takes to go against all of your advisors and say, no, we're going to put this before the American people's representatives. Well, the G20 summit in Russia is underway right now. The president, I'd love to be a fly on the wall in this thing. I would love to be a fly on the wall. But, I had a debate with Horace Cooper about this last night. He and I ended up shouting so loudly at each other that the entire TV studio, which has offices attached to it, everybody just was like, what's going on? Because we were just, right. I think that the whole whole issue, a whole variety of issues that need to be addressed are not being addressed because of the Syria thing. And in the context of the Syria thing, what Horace was trying to do is he was going off on this, oh, yeah, here's Obama leading from behind again. And it's like, you know, the right wingers, they've got their two or three bumper stickers that they want to slap onto President Obama, which causes it to look like I'm agreeing with that bumper sticker. I don't see Obama leading from behind. I think, you know, this, what the hell does that mean anyway? right? I don't recall that Dwight Eisenhower was landing at Normandy with the troops. You know, you saying Eisenhower was leading from behind? He was, but they figure out these, you know, Fox News and Frank Luntz, they figure out these little catchphrases and you know, try to apply them to the president. Yeah, I agree. President Obama painted himself into a corner, certainly inappropriately, maybe even stupidly. And I don't mean like he's a stupid guy, but I mean, you know, like it was a dumb thing to say. By saying, well, you know, if they do chemical weapons, that's a red line in, you know, in the sand for us. Oh, wait a minute. Are you sure you mean that? I mean, shouldn't you be saying it's a red, that should be a red line in the sand for the United Nations? Shouldn't you be saying, well, if they use chemical weapons, I would hope that President Putin would join me in saying that that's a red line for any nation. And there's no doubt in my mind that to this day, the president is regretting having said that and is trying to figure out how to get out of it. And again, this is, you know, you get back to the Fox messaging. Oh, he's trying to weasel out of it. He's trying to walk it. Well, to a certain extent, yeah, I probably shouldn't have said that in the first place. And now he's got this problem. And he's trying to, you know, look strong through it and also be constitutional about it. And I think it's biting him in the butt. And I think it's going to bite the Democratic Party in the butt. And that's not even, you know, addressing the real issue here, which is that human lives are at stake. And that you've got a humanitarian crisis that involves millions of people that is not being adequately addressed in the Middle East. And by the way, it's not the only one. There's a humanitarian crisis and a civil war going on in the Democratic Republic of Congo that is in many ways far worse than what's going on in Syria. But, you know, DRC, they don't have oil, they're not near Israel, they're not part of the Middle East, they're close to Europe, couldn't be a pipeline to Europe, they couldn't be a pipeline to anybody else, you know, quack. Although they do have a lot of mineral riches. So we're starting to see, you know, interest of some nations there. But it's a bad situation. I mean, we just have to acknowledge this. It's a bad situation. It's a bad situation that was not, in my opinion, handled well. Getting, you know, having John Kerry go out and make a Winston Churchill speech, followed by the president saying, well, not so fast. Let's talk to Congress first. Is not helping. Should have been better coordination within the White House. Or if the president was going to have a come to Jesus moment, which he apparently did Friday night, after Kerry made his speech. It would have been useful had he had that moment the day before, or at least warned his Secretary of State. So, you know, all of this said, it's so easy to sit behind a microphone in a comfortable studio in Washington, D.C. without, you know, and knowing that while my words may have some influence, I'm not the guy who's going to push a button that's going to cause people to die or prevent people from being killed. You know, the Monday morning quarterbacking is really easy to do. And there's a certain amount of cowardice is the wrong word, but there are so many commentators. And I guess in some way I fall into this category. I'm trying not to. But there are so many commentators who are just glibly saying, well, this is what it should have been. This is what he should have done. This is how he screwed it up. Well, here's what it, you know. This has been going on for 2.5 years in Syria. And frankly, as I said yesterday, I think this began in a big way, in a modern way, in 1998, when the Project for New American Century begged Bill Clinton to bomb Iraq. With a letter that was signed by Jeb Bush. May we never forget that. And others. I got to print that letter out one of these days and keep the list in front of me so I can just fast forward through it. But in any case, that was the modern day birth of it. But there were births before that. when Iraq, back in the 1950s, as I recall, democratically, you know, overthrew a military government and democratically elected, as my recollection is, his name was Mossadegh, democratically elected a president. And the democratically elected president of Iraq said, we're going to keep the oil for ourselves. And so we sponsored an overthrow of that government, and we installed Saddam Hussein. Same thing happened in Iran. Iran had a democratic election. They elected a guy. Maybe Mossadegh was their guy. It's been a while since we've done this topic in any kind of depth on this show. And we said, no, you can't have that. We're going to bring the Shah back. I mean, we have been making mistakes in that region for a long, long time. After World War One, you know, we took the Ottoman Empire and we carved it into pieces. We took, you know, four different states and turned them into Iraq, for example. So this is not, you know, I mean, it's Obama's problem right now. It's in his lap. But this is not a problem that was caused by President Obama. This is not a problem that was caused even by George W. Bush, as comfortable as it would be from that, you know, glib commentator's seat to try and lay it on him. We have had arguably almost 200 years of American foreign policy. You want to take this all the way back to the Monroe Doctrine, when President James Monroe in the 1830s, as I recall, said words to the effect of, anything that happens to any country anywhere in the Western Hemisphere is the business of America, and we therefore have the right to interfere and intervene. Thank you, Shano and Danielle. They just printed out the PNAC letter. Here's the guys who signed the letter. They said, they called it a Reaganite policy of military strength. This is their phrase. Such a Reaganite policy of military strength and moral clarity may not be fashionable today, but it is necessary if the United States is to build on the successes of this past century and secure our security and ensure our security and greatness. Right. This is where they say, if we shirk from our responsibilities, we invite challenges to our fundamental interests. This is, you know, this is basically where they were begging Bill Clinton to go into Iraq. And it was signed by Elliot Abrams and Gary Bauer and Bill Bennett and Jeb Bush and Dick Cheney, who was then the president of Halliburton, and Elliot Cohen and Midge Dector Forbes and Paula Dobrinsky and Steve Forbes. I'm sorry, Midge Dector. Steve Forbes is the Forbes name. Aaron Freiberg, Francis Fukuyama, who has since really walked back fast from being a neocon. Frank Gaffney, Fred Ickel, Donald Kagan, Zalmay Khalilzad, Scooter Libby, Norman Potterts, Dan Quayle, one of our great intellectual giants, Peter Rodman, Stephen Rosen, Henry Rowan, Donald Rumsfeld, Vin Weber, George Weigel, and Paul Wolfowitz. So, I don't see any easy answers here. The one thing that I do see, personally, is that we should not be investing American treasure and the potential of American lives in any more military misadventures in the Middle East. I'm all in favor of providing humanitarian assistance to refugees. I'm all in favor of building schools and hospitals, particularly in the countries that we have devastated, like Iraq and Afghanistan, and the country that we devastated called the United States of America.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But I, at the bottom, at the end of the day, my favorite statement is that from Merle Haggard, It's time to put America first. It's 10 minutes before the hour, 5 o'clock here on the East Coast, where you may be, whatever time it is. And let's check in with Bob Ney, former Congressman Bob Ney, now a reporter with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by Ellen Ratner's little charity, goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where you can get a crystal heart made by women recovering from the effects of war in South Sudan. Louise and I bought a bunch of them. They make great little gifts. Bob, welcome.
Thank you, Tom.
It is always great to have you on this program. So what's before we get into what's going on in the world, I'm guessing probably the top thing on your stack is Syria. But you're a former member of Congress and a former Republican member of Congress. I think you have a dual set of insights that I totally lack. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are before we get to the Syria part of it about the politics of how all this is playing out in the House of Representatives and the Senate.
Sure, Tom. I mean, this brings chills to me when I see this happening. It's just like history coming back in a different way. On the actual bill itself, nobody can really predict what's going to happen. There's internal wrangling. People are going back in the districts.
In the House of Representatives.
Yes, yeah, mm-hmm. Yes, in the House. I mean, you've got, you know, everything under the sun, of course, going on. The Congressional Black Caucus, Congresswoman Fudge, has asked them to please don't say anything on the issue right now. Everybody's sort of waiting for more information. And the big question is the president going to, you know, go on television, national television, and lay some, I guess you'd say, capital on the line? And I speak that way, Tom, because the inside politics of this thing, there are those who say, yes, you know, go along with him, with the president, and at the end of the day, you know, he's expended so much capital, so many favors, and that's how the system works, let's face it. And the end result is, you know, he's not going to get everything he wants on the upcoming budgets. I mean, people will tie this to other issues, and I think we have to be realistic on that. Also, the past issue of lies, people that were lied to by the intelligence community, I sat in that room myself so I can talk firsthand on that, is really making people extremely nervous of if an attack occurs, what information comes out after that?
Right.
That really puts people against the
wall. Are you,
a lot of internal politics.
Are you old enough to recall, or do you recall, when Lyndon Johnson went on national television and said the USS, whatever it was just attacked in the Gulf of Tonkin off the coast of South Vietnam, and, you know, I've ordered my U.S. military to respond, or I'm asking Congress to pass a resolution to respond to this?
Sure. I mean, I was facing the Vietnam War, and I remember that. I also remember the 1998. We told the Security Council it launched. There were some missiles launched in Khartoum, Sudan, with nerve gas. I mean, you can go on and on and on.
Yeah. Well, my point about Vietnam is that it was supposed to be small, short, limited, and that Lyndon Johnson, in my opinion, was one of the best presidents of the 20th century. Except for Vietnam. I mean, I was out in the streets. I got gassed. I got arrested protesting Lyndon Johnson's presidency. And yet I look back and I think, you know, had he not been the guy who took us into Vietnam with the Great Society, in my opinion, and I, you know, this is just my politics, I think he was, you know, second to FDR. And
he was a good leader.
He was. And I am very concerned that this is going to be the thing that does to President Obama's legacy and his presidency what Vietnam did to Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson died a broken man.
And it's a good parallel because we never know when these things start. Everybody said, well, limited strike, no boots on the ground. You don't know what's going to happen.
That's what the Gulf of Tonkin was supposed to be.
Yes, you never know.
Yeah. Let's just punish these guys for this transgression, and that'll be the end of that. Right.
That's right.
So anyway, okay. Thank you for the conversation. What's going on in the news?
Well, the big news, of course, is Syria and the give and take on it, and people want something voted on quickly. But right now, you know, again, it's up in the air. The president. In Russia, and of course, there's the normal smiling and greeting and handshaking. But I think this is the biggie. I mean, this is Putin, this is Russia and America with a bad relationship right now. So I would be fascinated to see. There's other issues that are out there, and I know they're not having the big sit down face to face. But I think everybody's going to be watching closely what in fact happens, at that conference with the G8 conference. So I think that's going to be.
Is Secretary Kerry with the president in Russia?
No, he's not there.
Yeah. It seems like a mistake that, given what's going on, that at the very least, if the president is going to refuse to talk to Mr. Putin, President Putin, over Ed Snowden, presumably, at the very least, our Secretary of State should be talking to their equivalent about what's going on in Syria.
Yes, and of course, there was a very intense statement by Putin calling Kerry a liar. On Syria, but that was over the testimony that they had in this week. But to the best of my knowledge, I don't think he's over there. But I would assume that if he's not, they have so much of a lobby factor up on Capitol Hill to try to get Syria brought into line that being a former member, he and Hagel have some ability to maybe grab some votes in the Senate in particular.
Yeah. What do you think this, the weird bedfellows kind of thing, the strange coalitions that are forming on both sides? I mean, the no vote for attacking Syria is going to be bipartisan. The yes vote is going to be bipartisan. What do you think that's going to do to the Tea Party's efforts to bring the government to a halt and sabotage Obamacare and the Obama presidency this fall?
Well, that ends that.
You think?
Any talk about shut the government down, et cetera, I think ends with this, because they're not going to have the steam coming out here. Now, Speaker Boehner, he's supporting this measure, this may actually send him packing. After.
Well, there was a report a couple days ago that he's not going to try. He doesn't want to be Speaker after 2014. I was wondering if that was because of the book that you wrote,
Well, it might have helped him along. I don't know. Maybe I did a favor, or maybe not.
I mean, in your book, I want to call it Sideswiped. That was the book. That's the title of the book, right?
Yes.
Yeah, in your book, Sideswiped, I mean, you laid out actual crimes that Speaker Boehner committed. I'm still astounded by it. Yeah. Anyway, and I highly recommend the book. Anybody who wants to know how Washington, D.C. works. Bob Ney. Bob, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, while largely religious wars are being fought in the Middle East, the United States is not entirely being spared, although we haven't broken out the guns yet with regard to one nation under God and the Pledge of Allegiance. There is a lively conversation going on about this right now. The Deputy General Counsel of the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty and the lead attorney on a case in which that fund is suing the state of Massachusetts, if I have this right, is with us. Eric Rosbach, BeckettFund.org is the website. Eric, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Give us a background, a little background on what's going on here.
Sure. So actually, I'm on the side of the school district in the case.
School district, okay.
Yeah. So the what happened is that for many years there's been lawsuits brought against the words "under God" and the Pledge of Allegiance, primarily by Michael Newdow, but some others as well. And those have typically been rejected by the federal court system, saying that it does not violate separation of church and state to have that in the pledge.
Right.
And that's based.
Is that the position of the school district?
And that's the position of the school district, and that's my position too. This case is a little bit different because it's in state court, and it's also relying on the Equal Protection Clause of the Massachusetts Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
So it's taking a little bit different tack than the previous.
Yeah, they're asserting that by saying "under God" instead of "under Allah," we are specifying a Judeo-Christian deity.
Sorry, I didn't catch the first part of the question.
There, my understanding of the way that the lawsuit is being framed is that this atheist couple who are suing you are saying that because it says under God rather than under Allah or under Shiva or under Buddha, it is basically specifying a particular religion, giving preference of one religion over another.
Yeah, I think they're, to be fair to their position, I think they're just saying that because it contains a word that is often used, you know, in a religious context, the word God, that it then is thereby making a theological claim. That is, it's making a theological claim about the existence of God, and that you know, even though these kids have the right to the absolute right to opt out of seeing the pledge, that's a problem.
I'm assuming you're familiar with the history of the Pledge of Allegiance and when under God was added and why.
So it was originally proposed just by a private citizen in the 1880s, or it might be the 1890s. It wasn't enacted into law until 1942.
And it did not have under God in it at that time.
It did not have under God in it at that time. It did undergo a few amendments prior to that time, but the first time it went into federal statute was in 1942. And shortly thereafter, there were a number of lawsuits concerning Jehovah's Witnesses, because Jehovah's Witnesses don't say the pledge at all because they believe it's idol worship.
Right.
And so
they don't fly flags for the same reason. I mean, it's almost a digression from the. But I mean, the under God was the response. My recollection, my understanding of it is that it was a response basically to the McCarthy era, to the godless communism. You know, we're going to push back against the godless communists and say that we're under God here.
Well, it's actually I actually think that the way it came into the pledge in the 50s was based on contrasting the United States with the Soviet Union, but it was actually trying to make the point that we have rights that precede the state. That is, that we have absolute human rights. You know, the Declaration of Independence says we're endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, which means rights that can't be taken away from us, even if we want to alienate them, take them, you know, send them away from ourselves on our own. We can't do that. We can't get rid of our right to free speech. We can't get rid of our right to freedom of religion.
It doesn't say that. It says one nation under God with freedom and liberty
for all. Actually, the term under God is a legal term and a legal phrase that's been used since the 1200s in the Anglo-American tradition. It first shows up in Bracton, which is basically the first English legal treatise.
So are you personally of the opinion that asserting the existence of a deity by a government entity is not a violation of the First Amendment's assertion that the government shall not select any particular deity for our country?
Well, I don't think the pledge – my position is that the pledge doesn't actually do that. The pledge doesn't say – it doesn't say there is a God. It doesn't say that there's a holy trinity or that there's a prophet.
It certainly says there's a God.
Like that.
We couldn't be under one if there wasn't one.
What's that again?
We couldn't be under a God if there wasn't one. I mean, it certainly says that there's a God.
It does.
And a single God.
It's as a presupposition as opposed to a proposition.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, why isn't there an S on the end? Why doesn't it say under gods?
Well, because I think it's actually a philosophical statement, and also that.
No, it's a monotheistic statement.
I'm sorry, what?
It's a monotheistic statement. If we wanted to make a philosophical statement, we could say under gods, and that would include Shiva and Buddha. Well, I don't think Buddhists even think of Buddha as a god, but you get my point. And Allah, and who again was the prophet? He's not a god, but you know.
Well, let me put it to you this way. Do you think that the creator that's referred to in the Declaration of Independence, that should be creators? Or
I think that the Declaration of Independence...
That people that came from different religious backgrounds at that time, including deists, for example, could agree on as a formula for what we... as a philosophical idea.
No, the Declaration of Independence is not a legal document in the United States. It's not part of our jurisprudence. It's not part. It's not part of constitutional America. It's a founding document. It's a declaration of independence from Great Britain, but not, you know, whatever the Declaration of Independence says is not law in the United States. So I don't think that it matters, the fact that Declaration of Independence.
It is actually frequently used by the Supreme Court to figure out what the law means in the United States, and it obviously is still in operation.
When?
We're not part of Great Britain anymore.
When has the Supreme Court referenced the Declaration of Independence in anything other than a rhetorical way?
There's a number of cases, and actually I think we've cited some in our briefing in this case.
Could you name one?
I'd have to go back and look at my brief for a cite, and okay. I don't have it in front of me.
Well, but beyond that, I mean, even if the Supreme Court says it, that doesn't make it so. But because again, how can I'm saying
so sure about that?
I'm with Thomas Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln on this.
The Constitution, what the Supreme Court says really. You know,
no, the Constitution actually, Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution says that the Supreme Court has to operate under regulations established by Congress, not the other way around.
Yeah, except that the Constitution gives them some power. So, for example, if, you know, the Congress decided to say the Supreme Court can, you know, never review a free speech case because we don't like free speech anymore, the Supreme Court would basically say, sorry, you know, the Constitution requires us.
No, they would not. They could not. You cannot find that in the Constitution. You cannot find judicial review in the Constitution. It's not there. It was asserted in 1803 in Marbury versus Madison by George Marshall. And there was such a blowback from Thomas Jefferson that court never again used judicial review. In fact, the next time it was used was in 1854 in Dred Scott, which just worked out wonderfully for the country. But we've digressed. Eric Rosbach, we'll have to continue the conversation another time. But I find it fascinating. I'm personally of the opinion it's time to undo the mistake we made in the 50s and take under God out of the pledge. And you're of the opinion that it's just fine there, and I guess we'll have to leave that as a gentleman's disagreement. BeckettFund.org is the website. Thanks for being with us, Eric.
Thank you, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Is it time to rewrite the Pledge of Allegiance? Maybe we could slip some stuff in there. Like, you know, not under the Supreme Court. 20 minutes past the hour on the program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? Or is the Supreme Court the king of the land? And we dare say, no, I don't think so. Although the current law says that they are both. Anyway. Kings and Queens. Sharon in Bellingham, Washington, listening on KBAI. Hey, Sharon, what's up?
Hi, thank you. In preface to my question, I strongly believe that we should be taking kittens here at home. I believe in the idea of the humanitarian aid over all this military stuff. I don't believe in the military strike. But my question is, in lieu of the military strike, if we're going to do something even remotely like that, possibly with a international coalition, hopefully, would there be an option to go in and take these guys out individually like we did with bin Laden and then take their little butts to The Hague?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is something I've proposed every day for the last several days, is that the very first thing that the president should have done, and again, money-boarding quarterbacking is really, really easy. But I think that the first thing that should have been done, once there was any kind of clear indication that that red line had been passed, and I'm still not certain that that indication is there, that there's no doubt that poison gas was used, but was it used by the rebels or was it used by Assad? And if it was used by Assad's government or his military, was it used by people in his military who were trying to sabotage him, who were trying to drag us into this thing because they want to see his regime fall? I don't know the answer to any of those questions, and John Kerry has not satisfied me or a number of other members of Congress. I'm not a member of Congress, but others, including members of Congress, with his answers, even the people who are privy to the internal conversations. So, but in any case, the point that I was making is that I think that the first and most appropriate response would have been to file a, whatever they call it, you know, a charge, a criminal complaint with the criminal court in The Hague for crimes against humanity against Bashar al-Assad. And then, you know, once you've got an arrest warrant issued for him, then you can try to take the Navy SEALs in there and pull them out, although it's going to be a heck of a lot harder than trying to pull bin Laden out of Pakistan. Apparently, you know, the Pakistani army, some of the elements knew where he was, but it was a fairly well-kept secret. But I think it's going to be a lot harder to get Assad.
It's an international coalition and agreement on it.
Yeah, there's got to be something. I mean, you know, when we went into Libya, which I think was still pretty dicey, we had a United Nations vote and we had a NATO vote, and we had both of them on our side. And right now we have none of the above. And you had the Arab League saying, well, yeah, okay. And, you know, we have none of the above. So, Sharon, thank you for the call. It's a thought-provoking question. Jeremy in Kansas, in Lawrence, Kansas. Hey, Jeremy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for bringing up Project for a New American Century, because that has to do with the situation that is going on with Syria.
I think so.
First,
by the way, may I interrupt you for a moment, Jeremy? Earlier on this program, I said that I had not heard from Jimmy Carter, and I wanted to know what he had to say. And a listener to the program shared with me, and I think it's in the chat room as well, that Jimmy Carter actually spoke out on August 30th. The Carter Center issued a statement saying, and I quote, a punitive military response without a United Nations Security Council mandate or broad support from NATO and the Arab League would be illegal under international law and unlikely to alter the course of the war. This is what President Carter had to say, and I think he's completely right. He's opposed to it. But back to you, Jeremy.
A couple additional points about Bandar Bush and the energy interest behind this Syrian move.
Mm-hmm.
There's an interesting article by Nafiz Ahmed in The Guardian called Syrian Intervention Fueled by Oil Interests, Not Chemical Weapons.
Yeah, and the subtitle is Massacre of Civilians Are Being Exploited for Narrow Geopolitical Competition to Control Mideast Oil and Gas Pipelines. It was published on the 21st of August. I referenced it at some length yesterday. Yes.
Okay, thank you very much. So moving beyond that, the other piece that we should mention about Bandar Bush and his talk, his alleged talk or his reported talk with Putin, is that he, in addition to the carrots, he also mentioned the potential stick of Chechen terrorists interrupting the Winter Olympic Games Russia. And so that points to the obvious thing that everybody who's paying attention knows, is that the head of Saudi intelligence, Bandar Bush, as a client of the United States of America, is running al-Qaeda, in at least these Islamic extremists.
There's a lot of assumptions behind that, Jeremy. The first is that the report of his having threatened President Putin is accurate. And I would be astounded. I think anybody who is not a head of state who would make a threat to President Putin would do so, or not just Putin. I mean, the head of any nuclear armed major nation would be making a huge mistake.
I agree with you. That is hearsay. Moving on to what we do know. In the same week that the Syrian attack happened, there was a declassified document, and this is to correct Senator Sanders about our relationship with Saddam Hussein while he was gassing human beings. We didn't just stand aside. When we found out that he was gassing people, and we knew it, and Iran was making claims that he was doing it, and the United States stayed silent. But beyond staying silent, the CIA provided Saddam Hussein geospatial intelligence maps to help him use chemical weapons on Iranians. We know that. Okay, so yeah. It's obvious that
we were also helping the Iranians, you know, in the same way.
Yes.
We wanted that war to continue. Jeremy, we're out of time. Did you, very quick question you had?
Yes, when is the left going to talk about the false flag possibilities of this beginning operation for another in PNAC's line of Congress?
Well,
you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I think I've been hinting at that for most of the day, but I think you just brought it right out, Jeremy. It's an interesting question. We'll be back. The bad and the very, very mammalatedly ugly. The good. Pope Francis, count the Bishop of Rome in with the anti-war crowd. The Pope says that he opposes Western intervention in Syria and, quote, cannot understand who gave the United States or France the right to act against a country in a way that will certainly increase the suffering of the citizens of that country who, by the way, have already suffered beyond measure. End of quote. To help spread his message of peace, Pope Francis will hold an anti-war vigil at the Vatican on Saturday. Is there anything not to like about this Pope? I'm thinking of converting to Catholicism. The bad! William T. Woodward. The Florida resident has a, well, interesting justification for killing two people this last weekend. According to documents filed by his defense team, Woodward was just following the Bush Doctrine, the logic of preemptive warfare used by George W. Bush to sell the invasion of Iraq when he shot dead two of his neighbors on Labor Day. Woodward says his neighbors threatened him and that he was allowed under his state's stand your ground, shoot first law, and apparently the single dumbest foreign policy theory of the 21st century, to use violence to protect himself and his family. Just when you thought the legacy of the Bush administration couldn't get any worse, some crazy in Florida proves you wrong. And the very, very ugly Deborah Brown Community School. The Tulsa, Oklahoma Charter School sent 7-year-old Tiana Parker home from school this week because, according to school officials, her hairstyle was inappropriate. KOKI-TV researched the story for local TV, and what they found was actually pretty shocking. Parker, by the way, is African-American and wears dreadlocks. Listen.
Why are you so sad?
Because they didn't like my dreads.
Fox 23 reviewed the school's dress code. It states hairstyles such as dreadlocks, afros, mohawks, and other faddish styles are unacceptable. The school feels that could distract from the respectful and serious atmosphere it strives for.
So basically, the Deborah Brown Community School finds natural African-American hairstyles unacceptable. And that is very, very ugly. That's incredibly ugly. Okay, Harvey in Berkeley, California. Harvey, you think Syria is a wag the dog situation. Can you explain?
Yeah, I see another facet to this impending war, and it's all about distraction. And if anybody, I suggest everybody check out the movie Wag the Dog with Dustin Hoffman and Robert De Niro.
Yeah.
And it's all about the fact that war consumes everybody's attention. And the corporate media, as I see it, the corporate media is now selling the war. And if the war happens suddenly, there'll be the news on fracking gone, the news on Fukushima gone, the news on the NSA scandal gone, all swept away by war. And the XL pipeline will easily pass under the cover of war. So I say just say no to the war in Syria.
Yeah, I agree. And as I pointed out earlier in the program, I think I pointed it out to Bernie Senator Sanders that, you know, he was talking about the military-industrial complex. Or somebody called and asked, you know, are they pushing for this? And he said, we have to, doing this from memory, I hope I have it right, you know, we have to keep in mind that there are people who make money off war in the United States. And it's not just the military-industrial complex. It's the media as well, or at least a large portion of the media, the cable television portion in particular. And even the so-called liberal network was pushing for the television network was pushing for the war in Iraq, if you recall back in the day. And it's why Phil Donahue got fired from that program, anyhow, or from that network. Harvey, thank you for the call. Mary in Republic, Missouri, Syria and money talks.
Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly, Mary.
am I on?
You are. You're on the air.
Oh, okay. Tom, you remember when you said about the men meeting in the restaurant saying they were going to take Obama down?
Mm-hmm.
I think this is just money talks. I think they have paid Syria money. I am not saying these people. I will be sorry if it really happened. But I want to say that I think these were all actors. They were made up because...
Do you think the video of the children dying from nerve gas or from poison gas was faked?
I think it was. I think the billionaires for the Republicans did this to take our minds off of everything else so they can get it passed. Because why would they come back into that country, the refugees, saying that it is so bad in the camps, and they would rather be...
Because it is so bad in the camps. There's no infrastructure in the camps. There's no police. There's no fire. You know, the rape is running wild, child abuse, the hunger, the food is contaminated, people are getting sick, the water is unavailable. Not only is there no air conditioning, but, I mean, these camps are out in the desert where it's 120 degrees during the day. It's hell.
I was a missionary to the people from the Vietnam War. They came across the Mekong River, the Hmong, the Cambodians, and the Laotians.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you something. They wouldn't have got out of that camp, and that camp was sheer hell. But they would not have gotten out of that camp to go back and let the communists kill them.
Okay, I understand that, and Alan Ratner and I were in a refugee camp just a while ago in the northern part of southern Sudan with refugees from Darfur and from Sudan, and a similar situation. Those people had escaped from a hellhole, and they were not going to go back. But that doesn't mean that because a few of the refugees in the camps. In Sudan, you know, around Sudan and Turkey and in Jordan. Well, actually, you know, Mary, you and I, we don't even know how many people are electing to go back into Syria. We don't know who those people are. We don't know if it's true. We don't know if it's five people and it made the news or if it's 50,000. I mean, we just don't know. I have to say, though, your belief that that video was faked. I have a hard time believing that. I I'm pretty cynical, but I think it's more likely if you're looking for a ginned up operation, and this is kind of the position I think that many of the people in the United Nations, Russia and Iran in particular, are taking is, you know, prove to us that Assad actually knew that was happening. I mean, it might have been that somebody in the Syrian government gassed some people and that the people who did it were not actually loyal to the Syrian government, not loyal to Assad. They did it in order to harm Assad rather than to help him.
Tom, money talks. And yeah. Just like the fracking, when people got really sick, they paid them money, but they were not allowed to say what their illness was.
Right.
They had become very confidential.
Right, I know.
And I think money talks.
Yeah. Well, I can't dispute that, Mary. Mary, thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing your perspective with us. Detroit Johnny O in Romulus, Michigan. Hey, Detroit Johnny O, how you doing?
Mr. Hartman.
Yes, sir.
I'm doing great, but I'll get better.
Okay. There you go. What's up?
You're absolutely right. There should not be no war in Syria, man. No bombing. Come on. It's got to stop. You're right. But you know what? Where did these weapons come from? Who did they get these chemical weapons from and when?
I mean, they bought them from the British.
The defense contract. Oh, the British sold them to them?
Yeah.
Well, they're the problem. And they were the problem in 52 when the Shah got kicked out of there. Yeah. They got us involved. Nobody ever attacks England. They always attack us.
Yeah.
They're part of the one of the major points of this problem here.
Yeah. And I can't say authoritatively that they bought them from the British. That was a report I saw in, I think it was the New York Times, day before yesterday. But that was reported that the British had been selling, you know, chemical weapons to the Syrians. Now, this was, of course, back when the Syrians were friends with George Bush and were providing torture facilities for his interrogation, for his extraordinary rendition efforts. So, but yeah, it's where did the weapons come from? It's a damn good question. Ben, in Chicago, listening on WCPT. You've got a minute to the break. Ben, it's yours.
Hey, Tom, thank you for taking me. I just wanted to point out, I've never really heard anybody say anything about it, but wasn't Syria originally a French colony and Iraq was originally a British colony? It just so happens that those are the countries that will help us, but they wouldn't help us with the other.
I don't know.
I don't understand why the United States even has to do this muscle flexing world show to begin with.
Yeah, I don't know who was whose colony or even if they were colonies. I thought both of them were broken up out of the Ottoman Empire after World War One by a coalition
right.
that included.
There were mandates of Britain and France, and then France lost most of theirs because the Germans took over in World War Two.
Uh huh. Okay. Well, you know more about it than I do, Ben. I'll have to study up on that. But you think that that's relevant to the modern day history?
I kind of think so. I mean, they are just backing up their. I mean, to use a horrible term, it's their children.
Yeah, yeah. Let me poke around into that and learn a little more before I say anything. Thank you, Ben.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
At 15 minutes before the hour, The Crash of 2016, by the way, now available for pre-order. My new book. Tom Hartman here. My new book, The Crash of 2016, The Plot to Destroy America and What We Can Do About It, is now available for pre-orders. Crash of 2016 is not just about the economic crash about to happen, but about the way we will emerge from it as well. Oh, this is where it gets hysterical. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 10 minutes before the hour. Ileana Ross Layton, she's a Republican congresswoman from Florida. And remember, 1980s, war between Iraq and Iran. Saddam Hussein has chemical weapons that were sold to him by Don Rumsfeld's company back in the day. You saw the picture of Rumsfeld shaking hands with him. Saddam Hussein's got chemical weapons. He's using them to gas the Iranians. The Reagan administration is not only ignoring that. A million people on each side died in that war. The Reagan administration is not only ignoring that, they're providing Saddam Hussein with satellite maps showing where the Iranian troops are so that they can gas them. That's what Ronald Reagan did. When he knew that there was a country that was gassing another country or gassing people, he provided them with intelligence so that they could do it more effectively. Okay, that's history. I mean, anybody who just reads the New York Times knows this. Or for that matter, if you listen to Fox News, God only knows what you know. But anyway, so here's what the former chairwoman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Ileana Ross Layton, the Republican from Wackadoodle in Florida, said on Fox News, apparently earlier today, I know that President Ronald Reagan would never have let this happen. He would stand up to this. And President Obama, the only reason he's consulting with Congress, he wants to blame somebody for his lack of resolve. We have to think like Ronald Reagan would do, and he would say chemical use is unacceptable. Ileana Ross Layton, Republican from... it's tragic. I was attributing it to Satayana yesterday. Shano looked it up. It apparently goes all the way back to Sir Edmund Burke. Those who are unaware of history are doomed to repeat it. Right? Doug in Kent, Washington, listening on KBCS. Hey, Doug, what's up?
Yeah, I was just calling to see The thing I kind of disagree is there's a standard that you're not supposed to get involved with a civil war.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why we kind of forgot that.
Yeah.
And if we're out there, I'd like to go after the money personally, you know, if they have yachts or something. And
well, the Assad family is a billionaire family. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
why is it there's always billionaires at the center of these things? I'm sorry. Go ahead. Say that again.
I like to see us take, you know, try to take their assets to help out the refugees.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a fine idea. That's a fine idea. Go to The Hague, get an indictment, freeze their assets, freeze their accounts, use that money to feed the Syrians. Excellent suggestion, Doug. Thank you for making it. David in Chicago. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to revisit comments earlier about Mossadegh. Mossadegh was a democratically elected leader in Iran.
Yes, I corrected myself in the next segment. You're right.
Yeah, and then the king of Iraq was deposed by the Ba'athist Party in the late 50s, early 60s.
Right.
But you have to go back to two things we have to remember. First of all, it was a Hashemite kingdom that was divided up by the British in order to parse out the lands of Jordan and Saudi Arabia and that area. So you have to look at the Hashemite tribe or family as kind of like the origins of these current political leaders,
mm-hmm.
In terms of the King of Jordan, Saudi Arabia. And if you look at all the problem areas that the United States has in their empire, our country's basically taken over the British Empire, Mesopotamia, Palestine, right. Straits of Formosa. Sound familiar? I mean, just same place, different names.
Yep.
We have to stop being the legacy of the British Empire. And if it's a British colony like India, let them figure it out. We shouldn't be the escape valve for their commonwealth or former empire.
Well said, David. Thank you very much for that. Ed in Erie, Pennsylvania. Hey, Ed. Halliburton.
Hey, Tom, how are you? I saw in the newspaper here in Erie the other day, they're doing a lot of that gas well drilling,
hydraulic fracking
here, that Halliburton invented the horizontal drilling.
They did.
Okay. Yeah. Well, the reason that Saddam Hussein attacked Kuwait was because they were drilling horizontally into his oil.
Right.
So it must have been Halliburton if they were the inventors who was drilling.
So Halliburton. So you're suggesting Halliburton was working with Kuwait to steal Saddam Hussein's oil?
I'm just telling you what the newspaper reads.
It's entirely possible, Ed. I wouldn't put anything past Halliburton. Nothing. Amazing. Thank you for the call. Roger in Kersey, Pennsylvania. We got a minute to the end of the show. Roger, it's yours.
You always give me the last minute.
Well,
I really like your show. I sit
thank
here
you.
For 3 hours every day.
Thank you.
Watching you. Anyway. And I like how you put the crackpots in their place. But anyway, I'm a veteran of that messed up thing back there 45 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And as a veteran and as a soldier, I didn't like the protesters. But as life went on, I realized you guys were right. Well, not totally right, but
yeah.
But I just wanted to make the comment that Mr.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you, Roger. And let me flip that around. You guys who went off to Vietnam thinking you were doing the right thing, there's a hell of a lot of nobility in that, too. So I think we can salute each other today. Tip our hats to each other. Thank you, Roger. And thanks for the call. So tomorrow, we've ended Anything Goes Summer, although it's been kind of serious first week of fall here. But anyhow, tomorrow's Anything Goes Friday. And we'll continue our conversation in Syria. Should we get involved in another war? And I'd like to get into some of the other issues of the day as well. Anyhow, don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag your it. Get out there and occupy something. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.